inviting us to do it with you. Luke 10, verse 1. Then Jesus summoned his 12 disciples. 12. We've done it before. It's to do with the zodiac. 12 constellations. They'd observed the sky enough, and they'd got the information from Babylon anyhow, that in a year, a solar year, the sun went through 12 lunar months, plus a few odd days, but it went through these classical 12 constellations. Well, the 12 disciples is the heavenly completion. It's every disciple. Every disciple God wants symbolized in this 12. And it also is a symbol of the cult, because this 12 disciples was also expressed in the cult. I'll read to you from Exodus chapter 24, verse 4, which says, Moses built an altar at the foot of the mountain, and he set up 12 pillars corresponding to the 12 tribes of Israel. By the way, this comes back into the Last Supper, when the only ones mentioned at the Last Supper, you'll remember, are the 12 disciples or the 12 apostles. Now, to argue from that there were only 12 there is to totally miss the language. There are 12 there, meaning everybody's there. You're there, if you want to be. That's what the Mass is, isn't it? We're there. So it's not a historical statement. It's saying the 12 were there, all the pillars were there, the universal world is there if we want to be there. It's a dramatic, symbolic statement of that this, what's happening at the Last Supper, is universally open to everybody. Well, sorry to go ahead to that, but it's relevant enough. So back to this. Jesus summoned the 12 disciples. So anything you see in the Gospel about the 12 applies to everybody. That's a key to proper exegesis. And he gave them authority over unclean spirits. In other words, they have a power to meet darkness, evil. They are to cast them out. And we've seen Jesus casting out evil spirits. That's the language they use. It's appropriate enough language. We'd have to find more subtle psychological language today. But whatever it is, we're talking about evil, and it's still palpably present in our hearts and in our lives, in our world, obviously. Whatever it is, they have power to cast it out, not just resist its entrance, but to overwhelm it, just like a candle has the power to clear a whole room full of darkness, just by being a candle. And to cure every disease and every sickness. And we've seen passage after passage, generally, or three or four of them, saying how Jesus cured every sickness and so on. And we've seen some particular scenes last week in those 10 miracle scenes. So they're going to do, in other words, what Jesus did. These are the names of the 12 apostles. So he now calls the 12 disciples, and you can see the change of term. He now calls them apostles. He will never call them apostles again. I don't particularly know why, but he doesn't. This is the only time in Matthew's Gospel they're mentioned as apostles. But it's an appropriate place to call them apostle, because apostle means missionary, one sent. So then he gives the names, which you're familiar with. I'll just read them without explanation. First, and that first isn't just an accident that it's first in all of them. The historical fact, it clearly is from the whole of the New Testament, that Peter had a position of leadership in the early community when Jesus died. A position that they understood went back to Jesus. And it didn't have anything to do with innocence, because his sin is clearly described. It had to do with the resurrection, it had to do with love, it had to do with faith, it had to do with the gift of leadership that he clearly had. And no one could deny that. Certain groups, including, or particularly, of course, the Catholic Church in communion with Rome, hold that this first Simon wasn't just a one-off thing in the early church, but for the sake of the symbolic unity of the Christian community, it has continued in that bishopric, which we'll call it now, that Christian community where Peter died, namely Rome. We've considered that that has continued. In fact, it did continue on in history for 1,000 years. There's no theological reason for it to stop. That's our faith. That's part of the essence of our communal tradition and history. And I think people neglect that to their own and their own community's risk of scattering and shattering and breaking apart. These are the 12. First Simon, also called Peter, the English word from the Greek Petros, which is a translation of the Greek of the Hebrew Kephas, which means rock. And his brother Andrew, James the son of Zebedee, and his brother John, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, who's been mentioned already, James the son of Alphaeus, and the man he calls Thaddeus. You look up Luke's 12 and Thaddeus isn't mentioned. Another person is Judas, the son or brother of James, is mentioned. Was it the same man by two names? Could be. Simon the Canaanite, or the Canaanite, or whatever, and Judas Iscariot, the one who was betrayed him. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions. Interesting point to make. It's interesting for me. It may interest you too. That verse 5, these 12 Jesus sent out, actually, they're not sent out till the last verse of the Gospel. Matthew loses all interest in this from this moment on. This is the missionary sermon, but there is no mission of the 12 in Matthew's Gospel. The sending out comes chapter 28, because they can only be sent when they've gone through the crucifixion with Jesus and come to believe in the resurrection. That's the theological point he's making. Well, now here are the instructions, and I guess as we read them, we're learning what it means for us to be not just disciples of Jesus, however beautiful that is, but an essential element of being a disciple is to be an apostle, a missionary for others. Chapter 10, verse 5. Go nowhere among the Gentiles. Enter no town of the Samaritans. Only time they're mentioned in Matthew's Gospel, the Samaritans. But go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That'll come back again in a later chapter, where Jesus said, I'm sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So we're dealing here, I guess, with a historical fact. That it's clear that his ministry only lasted 2 or at the most 3 years. He lived in basically Jewish territory, though it was mixed a bit up in Galilee. He spoke Aramaic, and he spoke to people who spoke Aramaic. He didn't travel. A very small world he lived in. It was known that he actually ministered to Jews. That's simply the fact. Now we've seen one already, and when people looked back later, when the church came to see that, no, you didn't have to be a Jew to be a Christian, you could be a Gentile and join this community, then one of the things they looked for was, well, did Jesus ever look after Gentiles? And they had to search pretty hard to find examples. But they did find some, just little touches. And they were very important to them as indicating the direction in which they were going to take. But clearly, Jesus and his first followers, for quite a number of years, were ministering to the Jews. Well, here it is authenticated, as it were, in Jesus' words. This is your work. Go there. Go rather to them. Paul, in the letter to the Romans, talks about the Jews being first and the Gentiles later. Well, that's the fact. That's the historical progression. I'll read to you from Romans chapter 15, verse 8. Quite an interesting text, I think. Paul says, Christ has become a servant of the circumcised, that is, of the Jews, on behalf of the truth of God, in order that he might confirm the promises given to the patriarchs. Matthew is faithful to that, sees the Jews as having a very special place in the providence of God, mainly because Jesus came from them, but not only for that reason. And Paul's, if you're interested in Judaism and the Christian approach to Judaism, read Paul chapter 9, 10 and 11. It needs very careful analysis and commentary, because it's written in a style of argument that wouldn't appeal to our modern logic. But it's very beautifully argued and very tightly argued position. He was a great debater, Paul, and in the Pharisaic tradition of his day, a leading mind. But their method of argument is not ours, so we have to... But when you read it, it's a wonderful three chapters of hope, faith, passion, love for his own people. There's clearly not an anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish bone in Paul, and of course there wouldn't be. He was a Jew himself, and so was Jesus, so what's the point of being anti-Semitic? It's obviously stupid. You'd be anti-Jesus if you're anti-Semitic. So, but here Matthew is maintaining the fact, the special place of the Jews in his community and in Jesus' mission. Then, well, let's move on to verse 7. As you go, what are we to do? When that no longer applies to us. But what do we to do? Proclaim the good news. That's the first thing. And if there was an exam, I'd ask you to answer that question. What is the good news? And all your answers would be wonderful. Some of them would be as good as mine and some would be better. There's no one answer, but there really is kind of one answer. The good news is about God, isn't it? And it's about what we've just seen in 10 magnificent scenes, where nothing can separate us from God's love. We've seen outsiders welcomed like the leper. We've seen a centurion servant healed, though he didn't belong to the community, and Jesus didn't even go and visit him because the bloke said, you don't need to. We've seen a woman serving. We've seen a storm at sea, not overcoming them. We've seen a storm inside and a Gadarene demoniac, and still peace can come even if we're broken in there. And we've seen a sinful, paralyzed man walk spiritually, you know, and physically. And we've seen a deaf and dumb man speak, and we've seen a blind man see, and we've seen a dead girl taken by the hands and lifted into life. So that's what we've seen. That's the good news. Nothing can separate us from God's love, and God is love. Well, that's what you've got to proclaim, he says. Not just with the tongue either, obviously, but with your manner, and with all that it means, being a disciple. The kingdom of heaven has come near. That's what you've got to tell people, says Jesus. That was the message John the Baptist gave back in, where it was, chapter 3. And that was the first summary words of Jesus in Matthew. Kingdom of heaven has come near. And here it is the same for the disciples. So it's the same message Jesus gave as the one we are to give. So cure the sick. Cure the sick. How do you cure the sick? What sick do you cure? No business of yours, no business of mine. God's the only one who cures. So be available to the sick. If you're a doctor, use all your medical ability to do it, and you'll work miracles, which doctors do. We're all still alive, thanks to the miracle of modern science, most of us. So that's a beautiful way of healing. If you're a physiotherapist, do it that way. If you're a mother, do it that way. If you're a father, do it that way. Just do it. And obviously, what's the one thing in common that all these people have if it's going to really heal? Love. And the healing that'll happen will be the healing that love can bring about. And sometimes love can't heal. I'm born with one arm, well, I'll die with one arm. And all the love in the world won't give me two. And you don't expect to, and you're not meant to have two. And you can love with one arm, can't you? So, we're talking about loving here, and that'll be very healing. Raise the dead. It doesn't mean wander around cemeteries any more than Jesus did. Dragging people back to this life to die again. What's the point of that? No, but you've been dead and people have raised you to life. Remember the prodigal son? My son was dead and has come back to life. So it's another form of death, but it's terrible deaths we human beings suffer. And he asks us to lift each other up from that tomb that we lock ourselves in. Cleanse lepers. Cleanse lepers. Bring outsiders into the community, the way our mums and dads did into our home. Stray cats, the kids brought in, stray people, mum and dad brought in. Let's don't we all do that? Isn't that what it's about? So bring them in. Welcome them. Cast out demons. People have cast demons out of me. I bet you've had demons cast out of you. However you think about it, but it's real. Any darkness that's locked inside can be. And most of us, we're doing it all the time, aren't we? Like a smile can stop it getting in. You think of all the people that you know, or even ourselves, if only there had been someone there to love them just at that critical point when someone was being inspired, perhaps they may have been saved from a life of torture, but there was no one there. I wasn't there, you weren't there. And so something gets in and it's like a little irritant in a what do pearls grow in? Oysters. And it's only an irritant at first, isn't it? A bit of sand. And then it ends up being a pearl. So maybe some of the irritants that we've got in us will make us the saints we're going to be. It's all very mysterious. But our job is to, before it gets there, to heal it with a smile and a word and a gesture. And many of us have been healed all our life. Demons got rid of very quickly. We hardly notice they're there. You receive without payment, give without payment. Don't take gold, silver or copper in your belts. Doesn't mean blood your ride everywhere you go. It means that your resources as missionaries are not going to be measured by your pay packet. You can't take the resources to do all those things. It won't be to do with money. It'll be to do with love, which is a sheer gift of God. Don't take a bag for your journey. That's a bag that holds food. So your nourishment isn't going to be, of course you're going to take a bag on your journey, and of course you're going to take a few copper in your thing, or everyone's going to have to pay for your meals everywhere you go. But they're irrelevant to the mission. Your mission doesn't come from what you take or I take. Don't take a spare tunic, don't take sandals, or don't take a staff. Sandals were for... Oh, by the way, if you read Mark, he tells you to take sandals and take a staff. So what Jesus' advice was in the real situation, I haven't got a clue. And it's symbolic anyhow. In Mark, Jesus says, don't take anything except take a staff and take a sandal. And people, it's the staff and sandal of the Exodus. Huh? In other words, you're on a journey. Take what you need for a journey, but nothing else. Matthew even says, don't even take that, because you don't need a staff, you're leaning on God. And you don't need sandals, you're walking on air. No, I don't know how to work that one out. But by the way, the other thought is, we don't know this historically, but you know how today in Muslim world, when you go into the temple, you leave your sandals and staff outside. In the Mishnah, the trouble is the Mishnah wasn't written down till the year 200 AD. That's the Jewish Mishnah, which was the oral tradition written down later by the rabbis in Palestine and in Babylon. There are two of them. They have there, when you go into the temple, you have to leave your staff and your sandals outside. So it no doubt comes from an earlier practice, in which case the symbolic reason for this is, I think it's a lovely idea, when you're going on a mission, when you're entering other people's lives, enter the way you enter the temple. Leave your sandals and your staff outside. Don't barge into people's lives. Realize that the missionary life is a very sacred one, very sensitive to the prayer, to the spirit-directed life of the people whom you are going to. So a missionary cannot come in and impose. A missionary can only come in and love and bring in the words of Jesus, the life of Jesus, which then the person will recognize and come towards when they're ready and in their own freedom. I think a lot of that is wrapped up in this symbolic language. Laborers deserve their food. And the text continues in verse 11. And here the focus is on peace. So I'll give you an idea of it before I read it, if I might. Peace, salam in Arabic, or shalom in Hebrew, it's a really, really fundamental concept. Sadly, our English language is poorer for it because it's come via the Latin, and the Latins were great warriors. War was what they were good at, the Romans. And so pax, from which we get our word peace, really means a gap in between wars. A very negative word in a way. When there's no war going on, that's peace. A pact is something that two warring people agree to, and the pact breaks down when the next war breaks out. So it's a gap in which there's no war going on. That's the literal meaning of, sadly, of our English word peace, but not of the Hebrew. Shalom means fullness of harmony. Peace happens in Israel when the sheep have got plenty of lambs and the goats have got plenty of kids and mum and dad are happy and mum's pregnant and plenty of life coming through and the wheat is kind of glistening in the sun and the hills are dancing with delight and the fish are getting hauled in. In other words, everything's happening. Music, dancing, the young people are getting married and dancing around the fountains and the old men are dreaming dreams and the old women are still racing around being grandmothers. No, so this is peace. It's the total harmony of a community where every instrument in it is playing beautifully and everyone's got their role, everyone's welcome and everyone's contributing. That's the image. I think the best image I can get is an orchestra where every instrument in the orchestra is different, is playing to full capacity, but very sensitive to every other one, and they're all playing within the harmony. And so the result is, you know, the last chord of a Beethoven symphony or something, and it's peace. Not peace and quiet, peace and life. So a peaceful parish community is not a parish community that does nothing and sits there quietly and genuflects and goes home. A peaceful parish community is one in which every person is being nourished and nourishing the others and offering their gifts to the community and all of that. Well, that's the gift we're going to now talk about.